Hi, I'm Nick Rigoretti's, and this is the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Podcast, the show for grapplers and martial artists that want to evolve both on and off the mat. Hey to all my Jiu-Jitsu brothers and sisters, I hope this finds you well. Episode 56 of the show coming up. As usual, I'd just like to remind you guys that you can support us by heading on over to store.jiu-jitsubrother.com and checking out all our awesome jiu-jitsu apparel and our books, videos, and other instructional material. We've also got the Tradition documentary, which is all about Roger Gracie and his amazing career. It's an absolutely fantastic film. I highly recommend you check that out. And we've got the new instructional from Mike Bidwell from BJJ After 40. It's called Headhunter, and it's over 4 hours of the most cutting-edge dynamic neck attacks you will ever see. It's hugely entertaining, and there's some stuff that I'm pretty sure no one's ever seen before, so check that out. And also, our new gi, which is the Enso 3.0, should be hitting the shelves any minute now, so keep an eye out for that. Also, please leave a review for us on iTunes. It always helps get the word out to more people and helps us keep doing what we do. Okay, guys, let's jump into episode 56 with Brett Przechalak. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Show. I'm here with Brett Przechalak, who I have never met in person, but I am told is a ridiculously cool dude. Welcome to the show, Brett.
Thanks, Nick. I appreciate you having me.
For sure. So, Brett, please, I know very little about you. Remind me where you're located, please.
So right now I'm located in New Jersey, and I'm teaching slash training out of Budo Martial Arts.
Okay. And who's the head instructor there, or you're the head instructor?
So my best friend that I grew up with, Charlie Vinch, it's his school. It's a Balance affiliate, so a Helsing Gracie school.
Oh, cool. That's really cool. And yep. When you say your best friend that you grew up with, I mean, what age were you when you...
We started doing martial arts together, modern martial arts together at about 14. So we've known each other pretty much most of our lives.
That's so cool, because I was just thinking now, in jiu-jitsu, it's very often the case that you make good friends that you meet in the gym, and they sometimes become lifelong friends, but it's a lot rarer that two very young best friends or close friends start training together and both take it all the way through to black belt. That must be a real special experience.
Yeah, absolutely. We started at the same place, and then every time that we changed gyms, we kind of bounced around together. As one gym would close, we would just go find the next one in town that would open.
Mm-hmm. And you guys, you came up through the ranks, you were graded at the same time or what?
No, Charlie's still a brown belt, should be a black belt soon. He's a traditionally Muay Thai guy, mm-hmm. But he's grappled, since we were younger as well. But he's really good at striking. He focused a lot on that for mm-hmm. many years, where I was kind of more like the grappling type that, I wrestled and did things like that to kind mm-hmm. of progress through the grappling. So we kind of were staggered in terms of grade and rank, but we've always trained together and always have trained, since we were kids.
Wow, I mean, that's so cool. I mean, speaking of striking, it's something, I did a little bit. I'm probably maybe blue belt two-stripe level in boxing. And I've been watching these dudes at the gym where I'm training and seeing just how much fun that boxing training looks. And I was reminded of how much I used to enjoy it, just the footwork drills and the bob and weave drills and just the heavy bag. There's something about it, I think, that... I think jiu-jitsu guys sometimes get stuck up on the fact that, like, they're jiu-jitsu guys. I've just got to train jiu-jitsu or even jiu-jitsu and MMA. But sometimes it's cool to go and dabble in other things like Muay Thai or boxing or something like that. And
I'd like to get absolutely. Into that. Yep, absolutely.
So yourself, are you just training jiu-jitsu, or are you doing any Muay Thai yourself or anything like that?
So growing up, I used to box. I went to like a Golden Gloves boxing gym, mm-hmm. not far from where I grew up. Once I could start driving, I would drive myself there and I would train, even while I was doing jiu-jitsu. And I've done tons of other stuff. I've done judo. I have a black belt in judo. And I've done Muay Thai, and things like Jeet Kune Do and Krav Maga. I'm always training. in general. So even when I'm not going to like a boxing gym now, I do still shadow box and work on all those fundamental things, just because they're applicable for, self-defense and real life. So I'm always doing that stuff, hitting a heavy bag if I can, or shadow boxing and working on footwork, just like you said, doing those drills.
Something to be said about it. I remember back in the day, I was quite interested in bodybuilding, and I was reading an interview with this monstrous bodybuilder who's now dead. His name is Greg Kovacs, and he was saying how for him it's the training that's the fun, not the competing, not the going and standing on stage covered in oil and tanning spray. He said, "I don't really enjoy that aspect of it. I just enjoy the training." And I think when it comes to striking, that's how I feel. I don't really relish the idea of getting hit in the head over and over again, but I do like all that kind of those Rocky training montage sort of scenes, when you're doing the skipping and the floor to ceiling bag and everything like that. So that's cool. So Brett, I wanted to ask you about you're doing a master's of science in strategic tactics.
Intelligence,
Sorry,
strategic
strategic
intelligence.
intelligence. Don't know what the hell that means, but it sounds cool. Can you share a little bit with us?
What I can talk about the program,
So wait, when you say that, you're implying that it's classified.
some of the stuff, sure, because just of the nature of the subject, and there's a lot of schools that have programs like this, even like major colleges like Penn State and stuff like that. It's basically understanding kind of like the how policymakers shape, the intelligence community, I guess, is the best way to put it. But even outside of government, kind of how, like at the after 9/11, like at the local community level, how like intelligence is driving kind of the way that like government shapes, the way things are. So everything from like your neighborhood watch, taking on a different role post 9/11, to all the way up to how they decide, how government budgets get broken up and what programs get funded and things like that. So it sounds a lot cooler than it is, but still pretty interesting.
Yeah, interesting. And I mean, if using what you've learned, could you explain to me and the listeners what has, I mean, the biggest changes that have taken place in the way our world is shaped post 9/11? I mean, something beyond the fact that we all have to throw our nail clippers away before we get on the plane.
Sure. So I think, and not even necessarily from learning through like a school program, but just in general, I think one of the biggest things that has kind of changed is that like everybody's kind of expected to play their part in some way. I think a really good example is, and they just made a movie about this, the guys that were on vacation in Paris, and there was the attack on the train. I think like one of the big things now, and this kind of plays into why I do a lot of stuff that I do when I teach jiu-jitsu, is that everybody's now kind of expected to take some kind of action. And like, it's almost like the community's become like this global community in terms of safety. Like, we don't always agree on politics, and we don't always agree on the way things are done in each other's countries, but we're all kind of like obligated now to try to like keep each other safe or save each other, if you're the best capable to do so. And I love the fact that that incident that did happen on the train in Paris, that the one guy like actually trained. He was a jiu-jitsu guy. Like, he was getting into that, and that directly helped him help solve that problem that day. And that's kind of something that crosses over from, some of the things that I've done professionally to the things that I've done, martial arts wise.
Interesting. I haven't seen the film, but it's my understanding that yeah, it's these two or three American tourists in Paris, and they're on a train that's taken over by some kind of terrorist with some sort of agenda, and they manage to overpower him. Is that correct? And they were given the keys to the city in the city that this happened, or something like that. I mean, it was a pretty big deal.
The French president recognized them in Paris, and I know two of them were military And one of them, the jiu-jitsu guy, who actually, I guess, sustained kind of the most damage during the altercation, I think he received the Purple Heart from the United States military.
Damn, that's pretty impressive. I think we all jiu-jitsu guys at some level kind of harbor that fantasy of one day stopping some kind of crime using jiu-jitsu.
Yep. Like, I think you're right.
And yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm the biggest culprit of all, but I think that generally I heard something many, many years ago, which was resist, don't fight, resist fighting with everything you can. But when you have to fight, when you absolutely have to fight, fight with everything you've got. And that's kind of the policy I'm using at the moment. Like if there ever a situation ever presents itself in which I feel threatened or in danger, I'm going to do everything I can to not get into a physical confrontation. But if I do, I'm gonna go berserker barrage mode for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's kind of just goes along the principles of self-preservation. You try to avoid the dangerous situation at all costs, but once you're in a situation where you can't, then you do whatever you have to do to get out.
Brett, I'm going to put you on the spot with something only barely related to what we're speaking about. I'm not expecting you to be qualified to answer this question. I'd just love to hear your opinion. And so post 9/11, everyone loses their shit and we have this, heightened sense set of regulations imposed by the TSA amongst other organizations. I travel a lot, right? So I've seen this happen over and over again. It's happened to me personally. I'll be getting on a plane and I'll have a tiny little like Leatherman type multi-tool, and it'll get confiscated, right? And because obviously it's a massive threat if some guy gets on a plane with something like that, allegedly. But I figured out this hole in the system, right? And I sincerely hope no terrorists listening to this because they could probably use this info. So let's say, hypothetically speaking, terrorist Rob Jones gets to the airport. He's got this plan, him and his three buddies, Rob Jones plus three. They want to take over a plane and they all need some kind of sharp implement to do it. But they get scanned as they go through the TSA checkpoint. And if anyone finds anything like a pair of nail clippers in their bag, it gets taken away. So that's not an option for them. So I was thinking about this the other day after I just walked through a security checkpoint and done the whole thing. And I went and sat down in a restaurant in the airport terminal near my boarding gate and I ordered a steak. And lo and behold, they brought me my steak and placed in front of me a fork and a steak knife. And I just thought to myself, okay, if I was this hypothetical terrorist, I could just put the steak knife in my pocket and go board the plane, and no one would be able to stop it. What are your thoughts on that? Because to me, it shows what a farce the whole thing is.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough one to answer. I don't travel that much, so that's never happened personally to me. But I totally believe you, that once you're, I guess through that gate, they're assuming that, it's kind of a secure, like sterile area, I guess. Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think, and that kind of goes back to what I was saying about how now everybody's kind of expected to do something. So I think the crews are a little bit more, kind of vigilant. I wouldn't say they're like hyper vigilant, but they're definitely more vigilant. I think people on the planes are a little bit more likely that if they recognize something that's kind of out of place, because I mean, at some point, hypothetically, you'd have to pull that knife out to use it. I think that nowadays, kind of goes right into what you were saying is, especially with the widespread kind of mainstreaming of jujitsu, there's a good chance there's going to be somebody on that plane that's like dying for that situation to happen. So you might get the knife on the plane, but you might not be so successful in using it.
I let the
And
record state because you know how the internet is. I have no intention of taking a knife on a plane. It was just a hypothetical scenario. The whole thing, I find it kind of bizarre, but also kind of interesting. I think to me, what's a bigger issue is you know, the fact that these guys are 9/11, if you believe the story that was told, I'm not putting any sort of value judgment on whether that's true or not. I mean, just the story that's presented to us is these guys took over planes with box cutters, right? Now, I don't know if you agree with me, but to me, there's a kind of, I was shocked to hear that. I was shocked to hear that no one tried to stop these guys. And I think on one of the flights, flight 987 or flight 97, there were some guys who tried to intervene, right? I just think the bigger issue is we are so conditioned to not make a fuss or not make a scene and just do what we're told as human beings from a very young age. It's like, just listen to the authority or listen to the person who presents themselves as the authority. And if you step out of line, you're going to get swatted down. And I've seen it over and over again, just with the nature of my travels and being in crowds and being able to observe people in different cultures, it keeps repeating itself. People like to be told what to do and don't necessarily like to think for themselves or to stand up for themselves, if that makes sense.
Sure. Yeah. I think what's interesting though is that, you know, and it's like, for me, it's like, I don't represent any government organization. I don't represent any political stance, but I think everybody can kind of agree, whether you're kind of, you know, far left, far right, somewhere in the middle, that is starting to change. Cause if you look at like what's going on with all like the, you know, civil disobedience things, like if you look at all these movements that are going on right now, mm-hmm. I think now people desire this like situation where they get to buck authority, where they aren't listening to those authority figures. It's becoming more and more prevalent, which is kind of why like everything is becoming somewhat more dangerous. You know, like a lot of people feel like they can't go places that have big crowds because they're afraid that there's going to be a violent protest, mm-hmm. or, you know, if you believe in a certain political party and like you have a bumper sticker on your car and you go park it somewhere, you're going to come back and your car is going to be destroyed. Like, I think nowadays I think like you're absolutely right that is kind of how we've been conditioned. And I think recently, due to frustrations or whatever's going on in general, just with people nowadays, I think that there's a big shift to where, you know, you see a lot of people, you know, fighting with the police more than they used to. You see people, you know, the protesters, you know, spitting on veterans, kind of like back when people were coming back from Vietnam. It's like coming back around. You know, even average citizens, you've seen, like you see the videos on YouTube all the time. It's a shame. You see like the people that play like the knockout game where they just go around, you know, hitting random people unexpectedly. You know, there's a lot of this that's become way more prevalent, which I think is scary, but also, you know, interesting from a sociology standpoint.
Definitely. Very, very interesting. I mean, what fascinates me about life is the deeper you go into any one subject, the more likely you are to find an inherent paradox. And for me, the paradox I discovered, as someone who used to be, I'd say, a borderline anarchist, and very much anti-authority and very much anti being told what to do, I was and still am to a degree very suspicious of governments. But the paradox is that at the other side of the spectrum, you know, human beings can be very, very stupid, especially when operating in groups and under the influence of sort of collective manias and crowdthink and groupthink. And a part of me thinks that they need to be controlled. We need a one world government kind of global system and microchips in our wrists and the whole deal, because, I mean, the other end of the spectrum is even worse to consider. And I guess I go back and forth on these two things, and I just find that paradox or that juxtaposition of those two extremes quite interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I talk about, you know, with my friends will, you know, talk about stuff like the movies, like the Purge movies, where mm-hmm. it's like, you know, one day a year, everybody gets to go around and, you know, try to kind of like thin out the herd, so to speak. But my answer to that is always, once you let them do it one day, then it's going to become, they know they can get away with it, so now they want it to be 2 days. And then, you know what, now you can't tell me what to do. I'm just going to do it whenever I feel like it. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I'm also not under the impression that everything we see is what we get. So I do think that there's things we don't know about, but I do believe that for the most part, at least in like the first world sense, I do think that the rules that are put in place and the governments that are, you know, in place to kind of, I don't want to say like control, but more like guide like the society that they're governing. I do think that at the end of the day, they probably think and try to have the best interest of the people like at heart. Now, obviously, humans are humans, and there's things like greed and other things that play into some decision making that people make. But I do think that you're right. Like, the world's definitely a better place with some kind of, you know, set structure than it is at the other extreme where people can just do whatever they want. Because, like you said, along with that kind of comes, you know, some stupid decisions.
For sure, and I think society, what I'm saying is nothing new. But when you remove the rule of law, you know that it took me a long time to understand. I had a very naive view of pre-civilized man, and I used to subscribe to the noble savage idea. I mean, which it's my understanding that up until pretty recently, people believed that, you know, pre-civilization, people lived in these tribal hunter-gatherer societies, and those societies were much more well-adjusted, and everyone just got along, and they smoked the peace pipe and banged on the drum, and they went for the hunt, and they were all buddies, and it was all just love and peace and in touch with the earth. But the more I learn about history and anthropology in general, the more I come to understand that that was very rarely the case. And most of the time, if they weren't hunting animals, they were hunting and eating each other. And it was a pretty barbaric state of affairs. I remember speaking to Jeff Monson. I don't know if you remember him, tough guy from a few years back, like very good submission grappler. And he was an anarchist. And we were having a discussion, and I asked him why he still subscribed to anarchy, and he reckoned that it ultimately led to a more peaceful society once everyone knew their place, once the strongest kind of asserted themselves and you know, created a dominance and took over a specific area. And I don't think that's true anymore. I think it, I mean, especially if you visited some countries around the world where there's a very tenuous system of governance, you realize that it is not a utopia. It's usually a fucking shithole, if you excuse my French. So yeah, I mean, it's been a very interesting thing for me to come all the way back around, and see that perhaps there's something to be said for governance, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and kind of something you just touched on is interesting to me. You know, where it's like kind of like everybody falls in line, like there's like a pecking order, and you know, a lot of times you see that in more of like the authoritarian regimes where, you know, somebody seizes power and now they can make everybody do what they want. But then you'll with that you also have like your best and brightest tend to end up defecting and leaving. You know, they go somewhere where they're appreciated or their skills are desired a little bit more. I think like if you look at like, you know, modern society now in most places, like first world countries, you see that, you know, so what's one person's definition of dominance is that, you know, okay, like in Jeff Monson's case, like he's thinking like that alpha male, like I can beat up everybody, I can kill everybody, so they have to listen to me. Like, yeah, that's great, but then like what about like mental dominance? So like the guy that's like the nerdy guy that, yeah, you could beat him to death with a rock, but like he's a lot more dominant when you're talking about like that guy's creating immunizations to keep said, you know, society up and running to where people, you know, can be fixed via medicine. You know, you talk about things like you know, engineering, like you want, you know, your bridges built, you want all your things, you know, created. And yeah, if you're in an authoritative society, you could crack the whip and you can make people do that, but then you end up having a place like, you know, the Soviet Union where they had all that stuff, wasn't that great, wasn't the best quality. And because you had that authoritative person kind of taking what they wanted and then divvying up the rest, you were left with this huge gap, and what ended up happening is, you know, the economy collapses, and so now everybody's, you know, kind of screwed in the end.
So I appreciate your insights on that, and I want to change tack a little bit because this has gone a little bit politics heavy. However, yeah, I do really appreciate your insights, Brett. One of the things I wanted to ask you is you, it's my understanding you train military personnel in jiu-jitsu and other sort of unarmed combat scenarios. Is that correct?
So throughout my whole jiu-jitsu career, even when I was younger, at the gym that I originally trained at, you know, we used to get a lot of military guys that were coming in to kind of better themselves, you know, make themselves quote unquote harder to kill, you know, like learning a skill set that maybe they're not necessarily being provided, through their regular training regimen. But yeah, so I've done a lot of that, training military personnel, training law enforcement personnel, especially through jujitsu, more so like the self-defense aspect of jujitsu, but not by any means am I one of those guys that like, ah, oh, street jujitsu is different from sport jujitsu, and sport jujitsu doesn't work in the street. I think that there's applications for all of it, and I've definitely done a lot of crossover training with military guys to try to, you know, make sure that they're as best prepared as they can be for whatever they're going to encounter.
So, just out of interest, like, what's the, let's say you're teaching a group of soldiers, right? And I don't know how they demarcate it. So, it's not a battalion or a platoon. What's a small group, like a squad, I guess, is.
Squad or yeah, a unit, a fire team.
Okay, so let's say you're training a fire team that these are all tough guys. They've all seen combat. I'm sure they've all been in a couple of fist fights in their life or a couple of altercations. And these aren't like the average desk jockey who walks into the street wanting to learn jiu-jitsu. What is the first thing you want to show those guys?
So it's going to kind of depend on them. I think a lot of times, like my approach is, you know, I kind of canvas the group I'm dealing with because also too, like you're like, you know, not every soldier is the same, right? So like there's different groups, units, you know, they have different focuses just like anybody else in life. So I try to gauge, you know, what's their biggest fear. So I remember, you know, I went around the room with a group of guys once asking, hey, what's your biggest fear when it comes to, you know, anything like physical altercation, unarmed, you know, combat wise. And pretty much everybody said, you know, ending up on my back, you know, is where they're most fearful because they have a ton of gear. They also have the responsibility of, you know, trying to retain their own weapons so that they're not taken from them, things like that. So, you know, that's kind of the approach I take. And let's say in that example, you know, they're afraid they're going to get, you know, thrown, dragged, or fall to their back. You know, so like I'm working just straight up like Gracie Jiu-Jitsu 101, you know, being able to kind of like track that threat from your back and kind of be mobile as much as you can, you know, getting on a hip, keeping your feet in front of you, defending yourself to a point where you can get back up instead of, you know, turning it into a grappling match. Like I always tell people, even my students, like for, you know, regular jiu-jitsu that, you know, I think in the jiu-jitsu world, we kind of have like a bad habit of saying like you play a guard game, like you play guard. And I always tell people when you're on your back, like you're fighting. So you're fighting a guard position. Like you're not playing guard because I think subliminally we kind of then connect play with having fun and less of a threat. And I think that's just kind of a bad conditioning, you know,
Interesting.
habit that we have. So I always tell people like you can, you know, play a top game because when you're on top, you're dominant, for the most part. So you're gonna play on top maybe, but you don't ever play on your back.
That is a very interesting perspective. I think I might work with that and adopt that a little bit because I have noticed my guard's been being passed a hell of a lot more lately, and I think it might have something to do with the fact that I'm being too experimental and maybe I need to tighten it up a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, and obviously, like we all know from, you know, doing jiu-jitsu for so long that, you know, you do have to experiment to get better. Like, unless you fail at something, you can't, you know, fine-tune it. But then I do believe and I definitely preach to my guys that you don't necessarily have to do your A game all the time, because then you never get better at like your B game and your C game. But when you do your B game and C game, it's not that you're playing it. It's like go 100%, like commit to it, do it, get yourself to that better like subsition, like a position you could submit from, rather than,
I haven't heard that before.
basically.
Subposition. That's cool.
Yeah, and that's something I picked up like a very, very long time ago. One of my coaches said, you should be training for a subposition. If you can get to the dominant position that you could submit from, you're way ahead of the guy that's just trying to go for submission after submission, because maybe they're going for the submission, but they haven't established that control and that dominance yet. So I always preach that to my guys, that listen, you got to get to a control point before you can attempt to submit that person. And 99% of the time, if you're in a position where you're already physically dominating them, the submission is just the icing on the cake. Like they're already beat once you're, like actually something I use a lot from your book is, how to kind of hold side control, like using that quadrant system and kind of using the angles. So once I get side control on most people, it's like the game's already over. They're done. It's just a matter of time. They're never getting up from their back because of the pressure and using leverage and body mechanics and stuff like that. And once I'm there, then the submission's easy. That's just they're gonna give that up. So
For
I
sure.
always preach that supposition.
That's very cool. Very, very cool, Brett. Well, Brett, my brother, I thoroughly enjoyed chatting to you and learning a little bit more about strategic intelligence. If the people listening wanted to come train with you or find out more about what you do, is there a place online that we can direct them to?
Yeah, I mean, if you're in New Jersey at some point, drop into the Budo Martial Arts Studio. It's in Ewing, New Jersey. And if you want to find me online, I'm on Instagram, so at Brett Jitsu.
At
That's
Brett
the easiest
Jitsu.
place to
Okay.
find me. Yep.
Well, Brett, my brother, thank you so much for you and 1,000 blessings on your continued journey.
Absolutely, man. I appreciate it, and same to you, and thanks for having me, man. It was great.
That was fun. I like doing these shows where I don't know anything or know very little about the guest because it allows me to go into them without any preconceptions and I don't artificially try to drive the conversation to places that I want to take it based on the knowledge I know about the guest. I mean, with Brett, I literally just got a recommendation from a couple of people saying he was a very interesting, very cool guy. And that was it. That was all I knew about him. And it was cool. I mean, I learned something new about an aspect of existence that I know very, very little about, strategic intelligence and geopolitics. I know next to nothing about those subjects, although I have been interested in them lately. I wanted to recommend to you guys, if you haven't yet seen it, check out the documentary on Hulu. It's called Active Measures. It is very, very, very interesting. My friend described it best when I suggested he watch it. He did so, and afterwards he said to me, "Nick, I thought the Cold War was over until I watched that documentary." I highly recommend it. Give it a watch, and I think you'll be quite surprised. Anyway, guys, I hope you're training hard. I hope you're having a good week, and or I hope you have a good week, and I will speak to you in a couple of weeks with the next episode. Until then, peace out.